Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Alice Sperry of The Intercept joins me to discuss her investigative reporting into the NYPD's brutal policing tactics of Black Lives Matter protesters last summer.
And Heather Digby Parton will help me run down the biggest news stories of the week. Plus, for our members, you will hear an interview I did with Samantha Henriksen and J.D. Duggan. They are two freelance reporters writing in The Intercept about a key witness, defense witness, in the Chauvin trial that just completed this week. It is a really important story. It's gotten some other play, but these are the two folks who broke it, and it is fascinating, a great piece of reporting. You can listen to that bonus interview, and it's a more than ever a reason for you to become a member starting this week. You can do so over at rofpodcast.com. You're going to be supporting the show and getting bonus content every week. Now, here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, you and I have been talking in one way or another since my days on AM talk radio, and I have been reading your work probably for 16, 17 years, I think, at this point, maybe 18 years, gosh. And one of the things that really grew the medium in which you started to write in which many of the writers that we hear about today started, was on blogs and the political blogosphere, I think at the time we called it, was in many respects born out of the push to the Iraq war, and in many respects was born out of a 9/11 and our response with the Afghan, the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, and that ongoing war that has been going on now for 20 years as of this coming September. And Joe Biden made an announcement that that the U.S. was going to pull out of Afghanistan. We just have 2,500 troops there at this point. And we were going to leave by 9/11/2021. And we should say that the Trump administration had made an agreement with Afghanistan, the Afghan government, to leave in May. I want to ask you as to like how legit you thought that was, or how, you know, your skepticism around it. But what's interesting about this, too, is that you and I have never heard, which is this is an unconditional exit. There are no circumstances on the ground that are going to change this determination to leave. Now, that doesn't mean that Joe Biden can't do it, you know, stay in there. But this is different because it's not a classic what they would call an FU, a Freedman unit, which was we need 6 months and we'll assess then. This is we're out by then regardless. I know you wrote a piece about it, but first, like, give me your take on the May exit.
Well, I don't know how seriously the Trump administration would have taken that date either. He never really got the Pentagon on board with his plan. It was always kind of an ad hoc thing that, I mean, in the piece that I wrote, I reminded everybody that there was a point in September of 2019 when Trump apparently invited that they were coming close to making an agreement, and to Trump's credit, and I give him credit for this in the piece that I wrote, he did sort of defy the Republican foreign policy establishment and the regular, you know, foreign policy establishment at large by insisting on that they were going to continue with peace talks. And he seemed pretty serious about backing it if they were able to find an agreement to get out. I mean, I think he generally, I don't think he understood the complexities or knew anything. He had his own motivation, which was he wanted to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And he thought that if he could create, you know, he could get out of Afghanistan and bring peace to the country in his mind, that somehow or another that would happen. And he put together a you know, a plan, and his people put together a plan sort of on the fly, apparently, from the reporting at the time, to bring the Taliban to Camp David, and that they were going to come there on 9/11 and they were going to have a big ceremony.
So wait, so just to be clear here, Trump had a plan to bring the Taliban to Camp David on 9/11.
Right.
So that he could have this ceremony and tie it in to leaving. I mean, I understand the idea of like the symmetry of like, you know, we're going to leave before we hit 20 years of the Biden's doing. I understand it. Like you would peg it to that date, but it seems like a weird thing to do, to bring the Taliban to the United States on that day.
It was outrageous. I mean, it would have been an absolute nightmare. You know, the 9/11 families and the military, and it's unseemly and awful. I mean, the Taliban, look, there's no choice but to deal with them. They are major players in Afghanistan. If we want to get out, and if the country itself wants to have any kind of a normal government, they have to deal with the Taliban. They're a power center within the country. But you don't have to bring them in for a big ceremony. This was based on Trump's Kim Jong-un thing, right? Which was also a joke. And Kim Jong-un went along with it. The Taliban didn't. Weirdly, they just said, no, we will not come there unless the deal is announced ahead of time. So they were unwilling to give him what he wanted, which Kim Jong-un did give Trump what he wanted, at least in terms of the pageantry. He kind of understood how that could work for him. The Taliban didn't. And so they did. They refused at the last minute, and Trump dropped the plan. And for the last year of his term, he just sort of went back and forth a little bit, but he didn't really make a big deal of it in the campaign. It wasn't a big part of his campaign, except in September of last year, 2020, he did announce that all the troops would be home before Christmas. We're getting out now. The troops are coming home before Christmas. Everybody went, what? What are you talking about? And needless to say, that didn't happen. So, look, Trump had his reasons for wanting to get out of Afghanistan. But to give credit where credit is due, he did set in motion the peace talks that they're run by Zalmay Khalilzad, who has been the negotiator for decades, I guess, over there. But they have been working through these agreements. Now, what Biden ran on this, and as we know, I think from many, many reports, Biden's always has been an Afghanistan skeptic. For many, many years. He has been one, he tried to persuade Obama to get out. He was always arguing on the side of getting out. He felt like they'd accomplished what they set out to, which was to break up Al-Qaeda and to break up that network that had been there, that it was just causing more trouble than it was worth, and that you couldn't continue this indefinitely. And he's been that voice. Obama wrote about it in his book. I was surprised at how forthright Obama was about his own position and how, you know, Biden had been on the other side of that. And that's kind of a historical oddity to actually do that. But Biden ran on this. He ran on getting out of Afghanistan. There was never any question that he wanted to do it. I think what we all wondered was whether or not he would be the kind of person who would take the risk. And it's risky. And there's just no doubt about it. They could, reconstitute it as a terrorist. What did they used to call it? A terrorist homeland, a terrorist, you know, whatever. Yeah, but, base, you know,
right.
Yeah, I mean, they could do that. And it's potential for, any kind of complications here. It's a risky move. But it's, you know, it's probably more courageous, I think, than we realize that Biden is doing this, because he's going up against a lot of establishment forces. But, you know, as with his big plans for infrastructure and for the COVID relief and various other things, I think he has decided that he's got a short window here and he's got to do the things that he said he was going to do. So, you know, I think here we are, and he made a smart move the other day when
wait, before we get into that, I let's talk a little bit about the riskiness here. I mean, I am of the mind that we should have left, well, decades ago, but just to be clear, there's a couple of different types of risks that are associated with this. Mm-hmm. One is that it ends up being a failed state again. The Taliban are certainly going to, you know, continue to take territory. They're going to continue to isolate the government. It's not a national government by, any means, it's unclear, you know, how far they'll go and at what point, you know, if the Taliban is outside the outskirts of Kabul, will we come back in? Or, I mean, presumably NATO forces are still going to be there. That is one of the risks. There, you know, people are going to be subjected to the Taliban. They're horrible. They're not quite ISIS, but they're you know, living under Taliban rule is horrible, particularly if you're a woman, but just in general. And so there's going to be, you know, we're going to. People, as we leave, there's going to be more death and destruction. And so that is in some respects on us and sort of inevitable the day that we decided to invade that country in many respects. There's that risk. And then there's the other risk politically. It could be like the least amount of risk that's associated with this. I mean, it's also sort of like alienating, you know, the. I don't think we have quite a deep state, but there is a institutions within our government, the military, sure. the national security apparatus, who are against this and all of the money that is spent on our war machine. You know, people making a lot of money over the past 20 years. So those are the risks associated. I think politically, I think it's time there, but. Continue on where you were headed with that, because I want to, you know, touch on some other things, but go.
Well, I think you're right about that. I mean, that the gravest risk, of course, is to the Afghan people. We don't know what's going to happen when we leave. We've been holding this arrangement together for 20 years. It's not a sustainable arrangement, and we don't know what's going to happen. The Taliban are, you know, it's a fundamentalist authoritarian religious sect, and they are, you know, not good for average people. But I did read some things, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who wrote this. It was actually in the New York Times piece about the agreement. And they were talking, one of the experts in the area said, look, a lot has happened in the last 20 years in Afghanistan to change the society as a whole. In a way, it's much more modernized, and there has been a lot of infrastructure improvement, a lot of, you know, modern communication. People are in, it's a different country than it was when we went in. We didn't nation build in the sense that we built something great there, because we didn't. But there have been improvements, and there is a little tiny bit of optimism, at least, that somehow or another this government, which is very feckless, you know, as many new governments are, but nonetheless, that there can be some kind of arrangement made so that the Taliban doesn't have the kind of oppressive control that they had before 9/11, when, you know, it was absolutely terrifying, horrifying. The other side of this is, I think the United States has a huge obligation here to the people of Afghanistan who helped the Americans during this period. And one of the things, I think it was George Packer in The Atlantic who wrote that about Biden back in the 1970s, had been inexplicably against bringing the Vietnamese refugees to the United States, who had helped the Americans during that long, disastrous quagmire of a war. And the hope is, I think, and this was in the George Packer article in The Atlantic, that he said that he was hopeful that Joe Biden had learned lessons from that and had a different perspective. And we've seen that Joe Biden has a very different perspective on a lot of things. Now at his age and at his sort of, you know, level of experience, he's different. But we do have, regardless, we have an obligation to do this. The fact that there are people there who are in grave danger because of what they did for the Americans over the course of this war over the last 20 years. And I'm hopeful. In fact, there's been a lot of discussion recently about the fact that Joe Biden has not they haven't opened up the refugee numbers the way that people expected, and that we're on track to actually bring in fewer refugees under Biden than under Trump, which is insane. I'm hopeful that somehow or another, what that translates into, that they're hoping to bring a bunch of Afghans into the country. Now, that's going to cause a lot of trouble, because everyone will, you know, how people feel about, you know, the terrorists and refugees and all that stuff. But I just am holding out hope that this is going to be something that they are going to do as part of this withdrawal, because otherwise this is, you know, an even more immoral situation than it already is if we leave all those people. And apparently there are, you know, many who are in process that have visas waiting to be approved, people that are trying, because they've been trying since they heard about the withdrawal under Trump. And of course, they were all delayed. So I'm just hoping that there's going to be a big okay of all those visas and that people will be allowed, especially, you know, so, I mean, you can just imagine what some of those people are facing if the when the Americans and they're, you know, it's a date certain. So, you know, they know how long they have and it's not a good thing.
Indeed. All right. Well, let's take a break here. And then when we come back, we get a couple other things to talk about in the news this week. So, Heather, in the last segment, we were talking about the announcement from the Biden administration that we will be leaving it unconditionally. This is an unconditional proclamation that we will be leaving Afghanistan after 20 years by 9/11 of 2021. You know, we talked in the last segment about the dangers this represents to the Afghan people. But the fact that it's simply not sustainable, our presence there, and that there's some, you know, risk associated with Joe Biden in terms of dealing, you know, political risk, I guess, in terms of dealing with the blowback of what is obviously going to has the potential of being, you know, difficult images and stories coming out of Afghanistan. Although, frankly, you know, my sense is the American public. We went through the entire Iraq war where the American public just seemed to be completely oblivious in many respects. And so my their sensitivity to that, I think, is dubious. The other thing, though, it seems to me, and, you know, you mentioned a responsibility we have to bring in refugees from Afghanistan. I seem to remember at the time when we invaded Afghanistan and that there was a real strong conviction. And by it seemed like the entire this entire country, all the different sort of, you know, corners, that we were not going to leave Afghanistan a wasteland, that we had seen what had happened when we had, and I want to remind people, we're worried about the Taliban taking over. We were very much I don't want to say the you know, exclusively, but we helped grow the Taliban. We funded the madrasas in Pakistan that did. We funded Osama bin Laden because they were fighting the Russians in Afghanistan. And it, you know, this was a conflict that drained Russia and many people believe, like, if not hastened, you know, was one of the primary drivers of the, I should say, Soviet Union at that time. Forgive me. The fall of the Soviet Union. And because of how much they expended there and Afghanistan sort of became, you know, people would make an analogy to their Vietnam. But there was a lot of proclamations that we're not going to leave Afghanistan, you know, a failed state, but also we're not going to leave it ruined. And, you know, you mentioned that there's been some advancement there, but our commitment to Afghanistan, it seems to me, has been really, really dubious over the years. I mean, really, really dubious. And frankly, you know, that country deserves a lot more from us than just our leaving, frankly. And I'm not hopeful that they'll get it. I mean, you know, we could have gone in and when we failed to get Osama bin Laden there, left. But, you know, George Bush wanted to head to Iraq and but also didn't want to have to deal with any type of outright, you know, failures in Afghanistan. And this is where we are. It is amazing what inertia can do, despite the fact that it is destroying tens of thousands of people's lives at any given point.
It's the second time in my lifetime that this has happened. I mean, this is, you know, Vietnam, we did the same thing. It is, you know, these kinds of conflicts. And if we haven't learned this lesson now, I don't know if we ever will. I mean, we are a mighty military superpower. But there, you know, there are extreme limits to what you can do. And the reflexive kind of response to 9/11 and the way that the whole country decided we have to, you know, we have to get revenge. We have to go and, you know, you've got to hit something. The fact that that happened, the way that it happened, there should be a lesson here in it, that we do not have the capabilities of dealing with, you know, problems such as this by a purely military reaction. We just can't do that. And I don't know if we've learned the lesson. I honestly don't. I mean, I feel like we're leaving Afghanistan much the same way that we left Saigon in 1975. And I remember it. I'm old enough to remember what that was. And I watched it on television. And I was sitting there going, oh my God. I mean, there were people, you know, you've seen the footage, the helicopters with the people clinging to the helicopters to get out of Saigon. And that whole memory, which I thought had sort of been seared into American consciousness, you know, didn't make a difference. When we needed to, we said, let's go in. You know, you remember the George Bush's greatest moment was standing up in, you know, on the with the bullhorn on the rubble of 9 and saying, you know, we're coming to get, you know, and we'll be coming to get them real soon. You know, it's like, really, this is how we did it. And it wasn't very sophisticated. It was very crude. And 20 years later, we are living with the consequences of that knee-jerk reaction. And, you know, and frankly, there were Barbara Lee is the only person in Congress who stood up to that. So, you know, it wasn't just a Republican thing. It was an American thing. And, you know, we really need to think about that a little bit.
When, Afghanistan, our involvement there, you know, makes me think, you know, over the past 20 years, frankly, I remember Gore Vidal coming into our studios, interviewing him on the radio and him explaining this. He had, I think at the time, a book called The United States of Amnesia. Mm-hmm. And I could not really understand in a visceral way what he was talking about. But when you start to live through these things, and you start to see it more. Mm-hmm. All right. We just have a couple minutes here, but when we talk about amnesia, obviously this week we had another instance of actually probably multiple instances of unarmed Black men being killed. In one instance, Dante Wright was killed 15 minutes away from where Derek Chauvin is on trial. And that trial wrapping up this week, at least in terms of the testimony. And so it becomes increasingly clear that that this country needs to fundamentally address policing. And, you know, the low hanging fruit to me seems to be police. No traffic stops. That would be a good place to start. But there's it is hard to see how this problem gets addressed in any type of meaningful way, because I don't know what more it will take.
I don't know either. And, you know, I don't know if you remember, but for years I used to document taser incidents that were being photographed around the country, and there were court cases and various things. When tasers first became, you know, ubiquitous in American policing, I was really concerned, because a taser is a torture device, essentially. And, you know, they were promoted as an alternative to shooting someone. But as you can see with this Dante Wright situation today, this week, was that the taser is used in ways that are still violent and unnecessary. That violence that was used on Dante Wright in that situation was completely unnecessary. And you mentioned traffic stops, and it's true that tasers are used constantly in traffic stops for someone who asks a question or someone who, you know, rubs the cop the wrong way. And there's virtually no, you know, any kind of repercussions for that. Cops are, well, you didn't kill you, did it? So, you know, we just tortured you a little bit when you didn't react. This is, you know, that's an aspect of this. And I don't mean to just, you know, hone in on that specifically, but that is a good example of why these things like, you know, traffic stops and others are, you know, they gave the police this non-lethal weapon, which they then use in a violent way in ways that they don't need to. It gives cops one more tool to take this authoritarian attitude toward people, yeah, which is just you comply instantly, you just do it, and if not, I'm going to either torture you or maybe I'll shoot you.
And what it is, it's not just a tool, it is almost an incentive, and it promotes it, and it's a there's a feedback loop here. And then when you combine that with a a racial prejudice that exists,
absolutely,
those two things keep combining into what we saw this week. Well, Heather, as usual, always a pleasure. We will talk again next week.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Heather Parton is a weekly contributor to Ring of Fire. You can find her writings over at Salon.com and the popular blog Hullabaloo. Now, Emma Vigeland, my colleague. Emma, take it away. What do you have for us this week?
Thanks, Sam. In the summer of 2020, the protests following George Floyd's death were met with police brutality en masse in itself, with many of the most visible instances coming out of New York City. Our next guest, Alishi Sperry of The Intercept, joins me to discuss her investigative piece, which uncovered the extent of the abuse of protesters by the NYPD. Welcome, Alishi.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start really with the organization that led this the beatdown of protesters. It was called the NYPD's Strategic Response Group, or SRG, which we'll refer to it as shorthand in our conversations. And it's a relatively new unit, started under Bill de Blasio, I believe. It's also not supposed to be dealing with protesters. Can you tell me a little bit about the SRG?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why we set up to do this story is that there is just very little that is known about the SRG. It's been around for several years now. It was started in 2015, and it was kind of, the brainchild of de Blasio's first commissioner, Bill Bratton. And the idea originally was that it was an elite unit, heavily armed, kind of riot squad type unit that was going to deal with both counterterror and civil disorder. Now, immediately, as soon as that was announced, there was an upheaval. There were civil rights groups protesting just the idea that the same unit would, equate basically protests and terrorism. And so there was a lot of pushback around that idea. And so James O'Neill, who was the following commissioner, promised that actually the SRG would not be deployed to protests at all, and it would only be focused on counterterror work, and then it would be sent as kind of a supportive unit to what they call high crime areas. That, of course, did not happen at all. That same year, in 2015, the SRG was sent to police Black Lives Matter protests. And since then, they have been front and center in all of the most high-profile protest cases in New York. When the SRG started, it was supposed to be a 350 officer unit, it had a budget of about $13 million. Within a year, the budget had grown to $90 million. That's for 2016. We don't know exactly what it is today. Again, the NYPD won't really say a lot about this unit, but it is estimated that there are at least 700 officers right now. And
I'm sorry, so
more.
How much did it grow from 13 million to?
To 90.
90. I just want to emphasize that for our listeners and viewers.
And that was within its first year of existence, right? And so what happened, I think what we need to take a step back. What happened that year, I don't know, you might remember, there was this very controversial surge in the NYPD headcount, right? Where under de Blasio, the NYPD grew by 1,300 officers, and a lot of those officers ended up being on the SRG. And the SRG is also an interesting unit because it's a voluntary unit, so officers could volunteer to join it. And so it tended to draw officers that, some of the early articles that were written about it, they interviewed officers that were looking for more action, which kind of sets the tone for what this unit is. And then there are a disproportionate number of officers who are on the SRG who have substantiated complaints with the Civilian Complaint Review Board, which is the independent agency that reviews allegations of police abuse. And so we know that, you know, that there are a number of kind of problem officers, so to speak. And you know, as I, and the other thing that I think is important to mention is, yes, the SRG was a new unit, but it incorporated the Disorder Control Unit, which was another anti-protest unit that had been around for some very high-profile protest cases. They were involved in the Occupy Wall Street protests, and they were the unit that was policing the RNC protests in 2004, which, as you know, you might remember, was one of the most high-profile protest cases in New York that led to massive settlements. There were a number of lawsuits over police abuse, and there was well, there were multiple settlements, the largest of which I believe was $18 million at the time. Following the George Floyd protests, we have seen several class action lawsuits. We have seen more than 400 individual notices of claim, meaning more than 400 people saying they are going to sue the city over police conduct last summer. And so what people are now saying is that the protests that we saw last summer will end up costing the city far more in terms of settlements. And of course, that's, you know, taxpayer money. It doesn't come out of the NYPD's budget.
Yeah, I mean, that as we've been seeing in conversations about repair when a Black person is murdered by police, like, the settlement money comes from you or me, and the officer may or may not actually be convicted. More often than not, they aren't, unfortunately, as we saw particularly in the Breonna Taylor case. But I wanted to move back to the DCU, the Disorder Control Unit that you mentioned. What was the history of that? Because it seems like it basically got rebranded and then expanded under de Blasio, who ran on a police oversight platform very famously and won based on those exact ideas when he became mayor of New York.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote many stories about de Blasio's kind of own relationship with NYPD and the way that, you know, he had certainly pitched himself as the police reform mayor and, you know, took credit for some changes to policing in New York that we saw in the early years of his administration. He was elected right around the time that we saw a federal settlement around the stop and frisk lawsuit. So there were certainly some changes that, you know, he just happened to be in office to oversee, but I certainly wouldn't see that he kind of like led the way in terms of reforming the NYPD. But you know, what you mentioned, you know, the fact that the DCU was incorporated into the SRG, and actually some of the documents that we obtained, you know, there's new material in there certainly, but they also took a lot of the training materials that was already part of the DCU and just kind of copy pasted it into these new materials. So it's really kind of like a recycling of the same tactics. And this is really typical with the NYPD, actually, largely because there is very little transparency. They don't really get held to account. They are able to essentially rebrand units that are problematic. And they've done this many times with street crime units that they've called different things over the years, certainly anti-protest units. And it's really a shuffling of, well, you know, rebranding and then a shuffling of officers around that they don't really need to announce publicly. So oftentimes, we, you know, the public doesn't even learn about this until years after it's happened. And, you know, that's not just on the NYPD. I mean, we obviously have a mayor and a city council that should be checking on them. And, you know, I think it's notable that the city council didn't even hold a hearing about the SRG for more than 3 years until they got involved in some high profile case. And then there was a hearing and, you know, nothing came of it, as often happens after hearings. But this is really typical. I mean, the NYPD has a long history of shutting down units and then a few months later resurfacing them under a new name. And so I think that also brings me to the point, you know, following the George Floyd protests, there have been a number of calls, including by elected officials and others running for office, to shut down the SRG, which I think a lot of people who were at protests last summer would welcome, but shutting down the SRG alone won't really do much if, you know, 6 months from now you get another unit pop up that recycles the same material and the same trainings. So it's obviously, it's a larger problem. It's not a unit specific problem. It's an NYPD problem.
Well, because then the unit will just become something else. They'll just call it something different. And even the prescribed role that the SRG was supposed to play, they're not doing that. I mean, they are involved in protests crackdowns, which, you know, I want to get into some of the documents that you and your colleague uncovered. I want to give him his due as well. John Bolger, yes. Both of you wrote about this. So the documents that you found or that you wrote about in The Intercept revealed one of the tactics being used specifically by the SRG was this kettling tactic.
Yes.
That's the colloquial term used by activists. But many police departments around the country use this. Is it technically illegal to use this tactic, or is it just frowned upon? And can you tell our listeners and audience what that tactic is?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I'm actually working on additional reporting around kettling nationwide, not just in New York. And it's there just hasn't been a whole lot of kind of focus in court, in legal cases around the legality of kettling itself, because usually when there are lawsuits filed, as is, you know, there are a number of lawsuits filed against the NYPD about some kettling incidents from last summer, and they tend to follow or tend to focus rather on the abuse that follows a kettle. So a kettle, which is what protesters call it and civil rights advocates call it, what police refer to as encirclement or sometimes corralling, but it is essentially the idea of, you know, surrounding a group of people, giving them no way out so that you can move in and arrest them. And there was a very high profile case of kettling last summer in the Bronx on June 3rd, I believe, in Mott Haven, when right before curfew, there was an 8 p.m. curfew in place. And right before curfew, hundreds of officers blocked protesters, peaceful protesters in the street, leaving them no way out. And then at 8 p.m., everybody was violating the curfew and they arrested dozens of people, I believe, more than 200 people on that night, I think. And, you know, this was very much a deliberate move by the NYPD. A day later, Commissioner Shea said in a press conference that this was a plan executed almost to perfection. I mean, this was by design. And yet, interestingly, when journalists have asked de Blasio or other officials to comment on kettling, there's always been some kind of ambiguity. It's like, actually, do we allow kettling? Do we not? Like, it seems like the mayor himself was kind of confused about whether this tactic is something that, you know, is accepted or not, and the NYPD acknowledges doing or not. And these documents prove with, you know, absolutely no question that the NYPD does kettle protesters. They have a number of different variations of kettling maneuvers that they like literally draw. I mean, one of the things that I think is most fascinating about these documents is that they include all these strategic, you know, drawings of different police maneuvers. And this one thing I want to say that I think is important is, you know, none of what is in these documents will surprise people that were there last summer or people that even watched some of these videos. So I don't think that, you know, people that experience that violence and or witness it need their experiences to be validated by internal NYPD documents. But I think what these documents do is that they really show that everything that happened was by design. It was by policy. It was not rogue cops or bad apples or things getting out of control. You know, officers on the ground acted exactly the way they had been taught to. I mean, it's such a key point, because over and over again, after protests or after other incidents of police violence, you know, you hear this idea that police need better training and more training and more money to do more training. And, you know, they aren't getting the training. These documents are like hundreds of pages of training material. The problem is not that they're not getting training. The problem is what's in these documents, what they're getting trained on.
The problem is the training, which is just, I mean, such a key point. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk more about the techniques that you uncovered, as well as the different lawsuits that the NYPD is facing right after this. So before we broke, you made the key point that the kettling technique, which is basically rounding up protesters in a way that they cannot leave so that they can be arrested because they are violating curfew when they are unable to move. That was a deliberate tactic by the NYPD, which is what your reporting found. And another tactic that you found was this bike squad that was being used, specifically in the June 4th incident that you cited earlier when we were speaking in the Bronx. Can you talk about this deliberate NYPD tactic?
Yeah, so the bike squad is actually a section of the SRG. It's a group of officers that are trained, especially trained to police protests or other kind of large, you know, crowd situations on bikes. And it's interesting that this is actually the only real innovation that we see in the SRG. A lot of the other elements of the unit are things that the NYPD was already doing under different names, as I said earlier. This is really the only aspect, and also one of the most recognizable aspects, I think, of the SRG. I mean, when people saw this heavily armed, riot gear cops on bikes this summer, that's what people associate to the SRG. It is not only officers on bikes, but they are certainly that. And what's interesting is that, these bike squads end up using bikes as weapons. And there are some really fascinating materials that we got that are in these documents where, it's fascinating because it is so technical in a way. I mean, and when I first read it, I was like, are they really teaching them how to like ride a bike? But it really kind of details move by move how you do bike arrests, how you jump off your seat to catch someone without really stopping, how you use your bike and this is something we've seen over and over again at protests. You do a line of linked bikes, right? Like officer to officer holding your bikes so that you advance and push people back. And it's interesting to see how they know, they say you have to push people, but you can shove people with bikes as if that were, something that in the moment you can really distinguish. So they have, what's fascinating about these documents is they have procedures and policies, and they have all this kind of nodding to the fact that protesters have rights and, acknowledging the fact that there is a First Amendment and that
checking that box before they implement tactics.
Absolutely. And, these documents are written by the legal department at NYPD, or at least reviewed by them, certainly. And so they're very careful in, I'm not an attorney myself, but I wouldn't say anything that of what's in here is illegal. I mean, I'm sure it can be challenged in court and I'm sure it will be, but it's, the problem is not that. The problem is that the procedure, the kind of the fact that this is the policy. I mean, you have this squad of officers who are taught to use their bikes as weapons to kind of control a crowd. And I think the documents are really kind of like speak for themselves. They're like fascinating to look at just from, there are little things in them that I think are really striking. But one thing that strikes me is the overall tone and language. I mean, the SRG came out of the war on terror, like a lot of policing of protests has adopted a lot of this war on terror mentality and talk. And these documents, you see that very much in these documents. You see officers referring to potential protesters as, hostile targets that you need to engage, and that kind of language is really chilling, I think, for anyone who's been on the other side of that police line last summer or at any other protests, and can really understand what happened to them as something that was deliberate. Which actually brings me to one point that I want to make sure we make. Absolutely. Is that the documents are very clear about the fact that in a protest situation, there is no discretion. Individual officers have no discretion. In other situations, they do, right? Police are told and taught that they need to evaluate a situation depending on whatever the circumstances are and make decisions. And, even if somebody is committing a crime, you don't necessarily always need to arrest them. There's kind of like a range of choices officers have. In a protest context, for the SRG in particular, there is no such a thing as discretion. Everything the officers did last summer had to be ordered to them by superiors, which also means that everything that, all the violations we saw, the mass arrests, the kettling, that was not just officers kind of, deciding for themselves that they were going to do it. It was something that was decided from up top, from department leadership, from the legal department, from it was policy, right? And so, and I think it is very important to stress that, and these documents make that very clear.
There is just this kind of compulsion on behalf of a lot of Americans where they want it to be a bad apple thing, and then I think it's part of it is this culture of individualism that we've grown up in, but also it's easier to think that these institutions aren't so rotted in this instance that they would have these kinds of policies, right? So anyway, that's just I find it's important that you're stressing that because of that compulsion that we're seeing. You want to add
Yeah, I mean, I think this kind of gets back to the point I was making earlier about training. We have this idea that, you can train people to be better, or you can weed out the bad apples and kind of just keep the good cops. And And I think we need to really, and you know, elected officials in New York as elsewhere kind of fall for this all the time. And they're always calling for more training or for better oversight. This is something else that we hear over and over again. And that hasn't necessarily changed things so long as, you know, the buck stops at the NYPD. I mean, they have the final say on, you know, all the discipline of their officers, which usually is non-existent. They have their final say on the training and everything. There is actually no independent civilian kind of control of what the police does, even though they work for us, right? I mean, something else I want to say about this this document is that, or the SRG rather, is that it's really, I think it's, you know, even though the story is certainly about the SRG, we want to make sure that people understand, you know, the broader picture here. Because as I said earlier, the SRG could be disbanded tomorrow and, you know, something else could pop up down the line that employs very similar tactics. And I think what we need to do when we talk about policing of protest is ask bigger picture questions. And that's certainly what a lot of protesters and activists and community organizers are doing. For instance, should the police even be there at a protest? Why do the police need to be there at a protest, particularly when the protest is about them? You know, what are they doing there? Like, we should ask these questions and, you know, demand our city officials ask these questions more often. Like, why are they directing traffic? What is the purpose of having the police there? And what is the purpose of having this heavily armed, you know, riot squad at a protest?
Thinking bigger, thinking a little bit bigger, you know. I totally agree. So can you just talk about how your findings square with what the state investigators found? Because for people watching, there are many, many lawsuits now being leveled at the NYPD based on what occurred over the summer. And one of them is the Attorney General, Letitia James. So can you talk about her, you know, some of your reporting and how that lines up with that?
Yeah, so there are certainly a number of high-profile lawsuits. There's the Attorney General's, as you said. There is one by Legal Aid and the New York Civil Liberties Union. There is one by a number of National Lawyers Guild attorneys. And then there are countless individual ones that are have already been filed or are going to be filed in the coming months. With regards to the federal lawsuits, a number of them have been joint, essentially, by the judge in the case. So they're kind of following through a shared path for now. But I think one interesting thing about this lawsuit, and with the AG one in particular, which follows the AG's report on the protest, right? So I guess take a step back. There have been a number of independent reports on the protests, including the one by the AG. And then there was a really important one by the Department of Investigations. And all of this, you know, were really scathing reports that essentially said the NYPD failed last summer. But many of them kind of drew back to this point that I discussed earlier. You know, they weren't trained well enough. They didn't get enough training. We need more of that. Or, you know, we need to maybe start this additional unit that's not the SRG, that's like a nicer or friendlier protest unit. That was one of the DOI's recommendations. I'm paraphrasing it, obviously. But and so I think, you know, one of the risks here and one of the risks of the lawsuits themselves is that they look to reform and change and adjust and kind of tweak things. And what's interesting, actually, I mentioned earlier that these documents are in some ways adapting the DCU documents from earlier on. And there are some, you know, in some of them, you can actually see the edits and there are little things change, like a line here and there that change as a result of a lawsuit that was filed at some point. And so I think one of the fears that people have that are, you know, welcoming the lawsuits, but critical of this kind of piecemeal fixing approach that some of these lawsuits set forth, you know, they're asking for reforms and monitors and changing training. And we've done that before. We've done that after Occupy. We've done that after the RNC protests. It just happens over and over again. And clearly that has not worked because here we are. So maybe the approach should be different. And, you know, I've been covering protests and police for many years, but I think that the conversation did shift last summer. I think a lot of people are kind of done with this fixing piecemeal approach and one reform at the time that they haven't necessarily, well, I think that there's just kind of like lost confidence in that process. And so they're looking at something bigger, like should the police be there at a protest?
Yeah, it's a managerial approach, which I think is often a critique of modern Democratic Party thinking, which is, you know, let's see how we can tweak this. Let's see how we can, you know, make things very technical and work around the edges in order to incentivize with grants. It's like a larger philosophical problem, I think, with the left in the United States. But I do agree with you that it's shifting. I wanted to ask you even more about some of the other tactics you found, because we really just talked about the bike squad and we talked about the kettling. Like, can you expand on, and we only have, you know, five-ish minutes left, 4 or 5 minutes, just some of the other policing misconduct, or really, I guess, just, you know, prescribed tactics that are reprehensible in those documents. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so we published 3 documents. One is the SRG's general guidelines. One is a set of modules, like the manual for their field force operations. And one is the bike squad set of manuals that I talked about already. And there are certainly things that are talked about in these documents that did not happen last summer. There are policies, for instance, around the use of flex cuffs, or around the number of people that a single officer is allowed to process for arrest, that, you know, we suspect were not respected last summer. So, for instance, something that happens over and over again is, you know, the officer who arrests and the officer who processes the arrest of a person needs to be able to say that they saw what this person did and why that thing was in violation of the law. And oftentimes, especially in mass arrest situations, that does not really happen, right? You have an officer does the arrest, and then the person gets handed off to somebody else who didn't see anything, actually. And so these kinds of arrests get challenged in court over and over. And the documents lay out very carefully what should happen. And we know that it didn't always happen. So there are instances like this. But there are also, I think, as I said earlier, the problem is not so much with what wasn't followed or the rules that were violated. The problem is that the overall message of these documents is, here is how you crack down on protest, right? There is this kind of like this sentence here and there about, you know, you need to respect the First Amendment and protesters have a right to be there. But then here, let us tell you how you can corral them and encircle them and break them up and mass arrest them. So the message that comes out of this is really, this is how you, you know, this is how you shut a protest down, essentially.
Yeah. Very quickly again, do you have any sense of, and I know that, you know, you've been following this closely around the country, do you have any sense of movement in some specific instances on the front of more holistic police, like even abolition or complete shrinkage on the ground, like any glimmers of hope in the situation?
I'm not sure. I mean, there's simply like the conversation has changed, and I think that's, you know, hopeful in itself. But one thing that we saw last, you know, and this has been a crazy year, obviously, we're still in the middle of a pandemic. And it's, you know, one thing that we've seen over and over is this kind of reference to the rise in crime across the country, in New York as elsewhere. And a lot of, you know, kind of like knee-jerk responses to that and seeing, see, you know, you're talking about defunding police and look, now crime is up. And actually, police has not been defunded really anywhere. I mean, there have been some minor adjustments to budgets in some places, but we have not seen the defunding that people have been calling for. And so, I mean, obviously there's a lot of work to do still for people that are pursuing that. And then there is always the pushback, right? So like, you know, as the reform, as the defund movement kind of takes hold, then you'll always get more calls for reform. And we saw this, you know, with the Biden administration as expected, you know, when people were calling for defunding police last summer, Biden was writing op-eds talking about how actually we need to give them more money so they can become better police and get better training. And it's,
yes,
we've seen this over and over again. And certainly at least since 2014, when I started writing about this stuff.
Yeah, I remember that Biden comment well, and not in a good way. Alishi Sperry, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this issue.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire. Are you still subscribed to the free show? Well, head over to rofpodcast.com. Support the show. Get extra content by becoming a member. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And don't forget, check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day. For Emma Vigeland, Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.
It's all right if you love me. It's all right if you don't. I'm not afraid of you running.